alcoholic. My name is Debbie.
Debbie.
Welcome, everyone, to the Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. For those who care to join us, let's open the meeting with a moment of silence followed by the Serenity Prayer. God,
bring us serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively, which are across the main foyer and up a small flight of stairs. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask that those present please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundation of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA's simple actions. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve a common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We're self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open big book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. And this evening, we're discussing two steps, the second half of step 8 and 9. Please welcome our panel for this evening. Laura and Amy is back. All right, so let's read the steps and then we'll get into the paragraph. So, step 8, made a list of all persons we have harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. All right, so we are continuing on page 8. And the first paragraph starts with, the chances are. The chances are that we have domestic troubles. Perhaps we are mixed up with women in a fashion we wouldn't care to have advertised. We doubt if, in this respect, alcoholics are fundamentally much worse than other people. But drinking does complicate sex relations in the home. After a few years with an alcoholic, the wife gets worn out, resentful, and uncommunicative. How could she be anything else? The husband begins to feel lonely, sorry for himself. He commences to look around in the nightclubs or their equivalent for something besides liquor. Perhaps he is having a secret and exciting affair with a girl who understands. In fairness, we must say that she may understand, but what are we going to do about such a thing like that? A man so involved often feels very remorseful at times, especially if he is married to a loyal and courageous girl who has literally gone through hell for him.
Laura, would you like to start?
Hey, everybody. My name is Laura, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Laura.
Well, I've never been married, so I can't really share a lot on infidelity in this paragraph as it relates to being in a marriage, but I like to turn it around to what I can relate to, and I can relate to having lots of relationship trouble in and out of sobriety. I've been the woman that was, with somebody that was in untreated alcoholism and wondering where they were and if they were out running around with other people. And you know, I can relate to that side of it. And also, just in sobriety, sometimes it's not just about, you know, what happens when we're drinking, but I can relate to being somebody who likes to seek comfort, ease and comfort, by getting attention from the opposite sex. So I really think that that's what this paragraph is about. You know, it's not necessarily something that I like to do. It's not when I do stuff like that for those kind of motives. It's not spiritual in nature, and it's selfish. And, you know, if I'm doing things that are causing other people harm, that's something that I need to look at. And aside from that, I'm going to be pretty short on that because I don't have a lot else to say. So I'll pass it on.
Okay. My name is Amy, and I'm an alcoholic.
Amy.
And I have not been married, and I do not have children. I never wanted to be anybody's wife or anybody's mother. But I have had a lot of experience with what goes on between men and women. I have been the woman who is the woman who understands. I had a nice run with sugar daddies and married men, and, you know, basically my attitude about men was that they're either an ATM or they're a sexual partner, and there's just no other point. So lots of selfishness, self-centeredness, and inconsideration. And I can't say that I ever really worried about the other woman, the wife, because I figured it was her problem. I wasn't doing anything wrong. I was not the adulterous one. He was, and he could have his own consequences. My selfishness, my alcoholism, my selfishness, self-centeredness shows up in every relationship. When I think that I am the most important part of any relationship, that's to the exclusion of the other person, and that's to the exclusion of the other people around me. And I've had to make lots of amends, not amends with sexual partners, which, I mean, I mentioned last week that I used to make up these long lists of all these guys that I just had to go make amends to because I, who knows what I did to them, but, I mean, I was just looking to get laid. I was going to go and, you know, we were going to have a big whatever conversation, and then, of course, you know what was going to happen. Because to me, sex is what ends an argument. Sex is what seals the deal. Sex is what gives me the guarantee, because that's what I'm always looking for. I want it to be written in stone, written in blood. I want you to swear that I'm number one forever. I'm so needy of being special, exceptional. I want you to make me the most important thing in your life. Which never is what I really want anyway, because then you're bugging me. Why are you calling me all the time? Go get a life. So there's my spiritual malady. Either you're not giving me enough attention, and that makes me mad, or you're all over me, and I can't get away from you fast enough. So I really see my alcoholism in the stuff that goes on in these relationships. In sobriety, I have learned to have relationships with men that have nothing to do with what's between their legs. I relate to people based on what's between their ears now. And it's an incredible gift to be able to have relationships where that little buzz is not going on, that little thing. And I've learned so much. And I also think that it's a way that my higher power has compensated me. I have two brothers and two sisters, and everyone in my family, my parents are alcoholics, everyone else is in varying parts of the disease or outside issues, and I have really been compensated in the rooms by being able to have brothers and fathers and be able to have these really clean, above board relationships. But I was not capable of doing that without working the steps, because if there was ever a problem, it was somebody else's fault. If it was going right, I was the star. Of course it was going right because of me. And so in that fashion, my self-centeredness just kind of perpetuated itself. I was always the most important part of any two people. And today I don't live that way. And so I don't have the infidelity stuff, but I really see it as another function. I mean, do I make choices in my relationships that are a function of my disease? Or do I make choices in my relationships that are a function of my recovery? Am I able to be an honorable person? Am I able to be to see what I can put into the stream of life instead of seeing what I can take out of it? You make me feel good about myself. You make me feel attractive. You make me feel powerful, whatever, whatever, whatever. That stuff doesn't have to go on in my relationships anymore. And it's definitely a result of this. And sometimes in amends where I have looked into someone's face and step eight really came to fruition inside of me and I could see that I had hurt someone. When that happens, when my higher power is doing that transformational work inside of me and I look in someone's face and see the pain that I have caused, it spurs me on to enlarge my spiritual life, because that's not how I want to operate. So that's all.
Thank you. We're going to go to page 81. Whatever the situation, we usually have to do something about it. If we are sure our wife does not know, should we tell her? Not always, we think. If she knows in a general way that we have been wild, should we tell her in detail? Undoubtedly, we should admit our fault. She may insist on knowing all the particulars. She will want to know who the woman is and where she is. We feel we ought to say to her that we have no right to involve another person. We are sorry for what we have done, and God willing, it shall not be repeated. More than that, we cannot do. We have no right to go further. Though there may be justifiable exceptions, and though we wish to lay down no rule of any sort, we have often found that this is the best course to take.
This is a brutal part of amends right here. And, I mean, it's not giving you really a whole heck of a lot of guidance on how to have these conversations. Being somebody that has been cheated on before, and actually I too have been the other woman before in the past, so it's a sticky situation when you're making amends and you know you've done somebody wrong, you've been unfaithful, and what if it doesn't say anything about what if they ask you a direct question, did you have an affair? Did you cheat on me? Because then it's either yes or no. But what it is saying is that, you know, we're not supposed to be naming the other person unnecessarily, and because that would give drama to them in their life. And I've had circumstances where I asked that question of somebody and said, "Did you cheat?" Thinking that I wanted to know the truth. And sometimes, you know, I've talked to my sponsor about this situation several times over the, you know, my course of sobriety about what's the right thing to do. What if you know somebody in AA that's cheating, you know, having an affair? You know, what's the right thing to do? Are we supposed to keep our mouth shut, or do we tell the person? What if it's your best friend, and you know your best friend is being cheated on? And you know, I've had, you know, sponsorship that's directed me to keep my mouth shut and, you know, let God take care of the situation. And I've also had other people say that you have to do right by your friend. And it's just one of those situations where, you know, I really feel like it's something that's between, you know, for me, it's between me and God, and what, you know, what can I sleep with that night? But as far as, you know, me revealing something that's going to possibly cause harm to another person, to a third party, it says I have no right to cause that other person harm. And so that part is very clear. And then I like how it says, you know, we can confess in a general way that we've been wild. I mean, I'm just sitting there trying to imagine having that conversation with somebody if I was the adulterer or whatever. And I don't know, this is not an easy situation, but obviously it's in here for a reason and it needs to be addressed. That's all I have.
I have been with the same partner for 14 years, and God bless him, his character is so much better than mine. And I had to make amends to him for spending money behind his back. And the way that I make amends is I go to someone and I say, this is why I'm here. This is what I'm doing. I need to do this or I'm not going to be able to stay sober. I am aware that I have harmed you. Here's how I have harmed you. I am sorry for how I have harmed you. What can I do to make it right? And I have got a big mouth, and I have a tendency to talk way more than I need to. And so I would say all of the stuff. And I spent $13,000 behind his back one summer on jewelry on eBay. And I wasn't going to give it back. I wasn't going to send it back either. I mean, I wanted to keep it. But I knew that I had to tell him what I had done. And so I went to him, and, you know, I start my whole thing. And he says to me, hang on. Do not tell me some number that I will never be able to get out of my head. And, you know, I'm wanting to get this off my chest. You know, I want to be totally transparent in my relationship. I want him to know everything so that I can feel better. But that's not the point of this. This is not so I can feel better. And he said, here's what I want to know. Are you sorry you did it? Absolutely. I'm very, very sorry. And then he said, are you going to do it again? I said, I am not going to do it again, which I have not done it again. And he said, okay, that's it. And it just sucked because I wanted to be spanked. I wanted to be punished. I wanted to, you know, I wanted to get it done and move on to the next episode. And what I learned from that, though, was that this process is about me growing up and taking responsibility for myself. He's not my daddy. He's not going to give me a spanking because I've been a bad girl. He's my partner. He wants me to be as honorable as he is. And after that happened, I started thinking about other circumstances. And I realized that when people have come to me and told me stuff, I get really like the Gestapo. I am an interrogator. I am very curious. And I will extricate whatever I want from you. I will have my way with you. I will impose my will. But I am usually so sorry that I did. It's so much worse to get every little detail because then I've got the whole visual in my head. It doesn't do me any good. And I realize that it's the illusion of control. I think that if I get all the details, every little thing that happened, you know, is she prettier than I am? Was it, but you know, whatever that crap is that I have to do to make myself feel better, make myself feel superior, it doesn't make me feel better. It makes me feel worse. And so this is why I don't get to barge into people's lives and just unload on them so that I can have a clear conscience. I don't get to disrupt somebody else's, you know, I don't get to harsh someone else's mellow. Whatever it is that they've got, whatever it is that they've got in their head that makes them be okay, I don't have a right to go screw with that. And I am a person that has had a lot of trouble knowing the difference between what is my business and what is not my business. Because I think that just about everything is my business. And that is why I have fellows that I call and say, can you give me a reality check? What does this sound like to you? And I have a sponsor that I call. I heard someone say recently that he was just learning how to call a sponsor before he did something instead of waiting until after he had done it and then calling the sponsor to help him clean it up. That's what's going on here for me. Step nine is forcing me to grow up. And thank God that I didn't grow up before now because it's ugly and it's awkward. And I get to do it now amongst friends. And part of that is taking responsibility for myself in step nine, but doing it in a clean way where I'm not making you be my punisher so that I get to feel okay about myself. That's all.
Thank you. All right, we're going to go to page 82. If we have no such complication, there is plenty we should do at home. Sometimes we hear an alcoholic say that the only thing he needs to do is to keep sober. Certainly, he must keep sober, for there will be no home if he doesn't. But he is yet a long way from making good to the wife or parents whom for years he has so shockingly treated. Passing all understanding is the patience mothers and wives have had with alcoholics. Had this not been so, many of us would have no homes today, would perhaps be dead. The alcoholic is like a tornado roaring his way through the lives of others. Hearts are broken, sweet relationships are dead, affections have been uprooted. Selfish and inconsiderate habits have kept the home in turmoil. We feel a man is unthinking when he says that sobriety is enough. He's like the farmer who came up out of his cyclone cellar to find his home ruined. To his wife, he remarked, "Don't see anything the matter here, Mom. Ain't it grand the wind stopped blowing?"
I love that analogy. That's me. I am the tornado. I am Tasmanian devil. And when I first got sober, I was still living at home with my parents. I was 22. And I remember I was fresh out of rehab, did 2 months in rehab. I was waiting my court date. I had 5 years I was facing. And I was going to meetings all the time and praying my butt off and, you know, just trying to learn and adjust to being sober and trying really hard not to drink, you know, before I went to court. And I remember my father one night, I don't even know what I was upset about, but he came home and I just had this sense of entitlement. He questioned me about my whereabouts or where I was going, and I was just going to hang out with some people in AA after a meeting, but we're going to go out late. And I think he didn't really trust me yet, and I'm only 2 months sober. And I remember I threw a fit in front of him, and he accused me of, he's like, "You're not really sober." He's like, "Are you on drugs or something?" And I was like, totally offended that he was accusing me. I'm like, "I'm 2 months sober, and you've seen me every night, and how dare you accuse me of not being sober?" And what I didn't get was that I wasn't acting sober. I was acting like a spoiled brat throwing a temper tantrum, you know, demanding my way. And that's what this is talking about. And just like getting sober is growing up. And, you know, I've been sober for multiple years now, and I didn't stay sober after the 22 years old. I got sober for 5 years and decided I wanted to give drinking a try again, and, you know, somehow I made it back here. But being sober under all circumstances is difficult. And, you know, I have a close friend of mine, actually several close friends of mine, one of them I've been trying to work with, chronic relapser. We have a lot of similar, you know, life experiences. You know, the tragedies we both face are pretty similar. And I ask her, she's like, "I just don't know why I can't get this. You know, I can't get this AA thing. And, you know, I keep drinking." And I said, "What do you think the difference is between you and me?" I was like, "The only difference, it's not what we've been through. You know, the things that have happened to us are very similar. The only difference is that I do this no matter what. No matter how I feel, I do this when I'm feeling bad. I have to. You know, it's easy to be sober when I'm feeling good. It's easy to behave myself and act grown up. But when I don't get my way, when somebody gets in my face and, you know, curses at me, when, you know, I lose friends, lose jobs, you know, lose loved ones to death, you know, how do I keep myself from acting like the tornado during those times?" And I can tell you that I'm not always so graceful about it, but the point is I didn't get sober just to keep acting like the same jerk I was when I got here. You know, I need to learn how to grow spiritually and how to become a better person and the best version of me that I believe that God wants me to be. And if I'm not continuously looking at my behavior, my thinking, and my actions, and questioning these things, and then You know, it starts with the awareness that there's a problem with my behavior, but that's not, you know, step nine is not just about the awareness. Step nine is taking the action to amend my behavior. I can't tell you how many times I've thrown that word, I'm sorry, out to my family, to my friends, to, you know, whoever. But sorry doesn't mean shit. It doesn't. It doesn't mean anything when I continuously make the same mistakes over and over again. I have to change my behavior. I have to amend my behavior. You know, so saying, oh, you should just be happy that I'm sober. Just be glad that I'm not getting DUIs anymore. You know, it's not enough because there's not enough time to go into the crazy stuff that I put my family through just growing up as a teenager. The money that I cost them, you know, they were always bailing me out of jail and paying for the lawyers and putting me into institutions and special schools because I couldn't take it in the public high school, and counselors and doctors and prescriptions, and I was awful. So the hearts are broken, sweet relationships are dead. I mean, I got to a place with my father where he, I was kicked out of where I was staying, and I was not living with him at the time, but I was on probation as a minor, and if I got in trouble, I would have gone away for a long time, and my father told my mom, he said, just leave her on the streets. And my father loves me. And, but that's what I did to my parents. My parents had lost all hope over me ever turning my life around because I didn't want it. I didn't want it. And that's the thing, you know, I'm telling my friends, like, I can't make you want this. I can't make you do the work. It's not just about putting a check in the box, step 1, 2, 3, all the way to 12, I'm done. Going to meetings, behaving myself for an hour in a meeting. What do you do when you go home? What do you do when you're upset, when you're depressed, when you get your feelings hurt, when you get pissed off? What do? You going to pick up the bottle? Or are you going to pick up the phone and call for help? And that's the only thing that's different between me and the person that's a chronic relapser, is I ask for help. I take the action. That's it.
Thank you, Laura.
I definitely spent the first 10 years of my sobriety with this attitude. And I heard a lot of stuff, too, that, I mean, I'm not blaming it on what I heard, but I heard a lot of things that kind of reinforced that, like, you know, it. So what if it was a horrible day? If you didn't take a drink, you're a winner. And that was good enough for me. So, I mean, I raped and pillaged for a decade, and I wasn't drinking, and I wasn't happy at all. And I had people every once in a while, I mean, people that I would listen to, because I didn't really listen to anyone, but I would have people every once in a while say, you're so angry. And I would think, I'm not angry at all. I really didn't think I was angry. My ego was so defended that I could not hear what other people were saying to me. But, you know, when the evidence starts mounting, when I'm driving like a maniac down the road and cussing people out or jumping out of the car at a light and, you know, threatening someone, which, well, I mean, I've never hit anyone in my life, but I just seem like the kind of person that would beat you to death. So, you know, they see me coming and waving my arms and I just get my way. And I'm smiling. I'm really not proud of that. That's not good. But it took a lot of unhappiness for me to start looking around to find someone who could explain to me how this spiritual transformation thing took place. Because I really thought that it was go to meetings, get a sponsor, go to a lot of meetings, do service. You know, back then it was cleaning out the ashtrays. I cleaned out ashtrays all the time, all this kind of stuff. And I was doing everything that had been suggested to me, but I was still that sober horse thief you could have hit me over the head with a value, and I wouldn't have known what it was. And I wouldn't have cared either, because if I'm smart enough to get over on you, you deserve it. And I really felt that way years, at least 10 years into sobriety, until somebody got a hold of me that worked the steps directly out of the big book. And it started becoming clear to me that I was not working the steps to stay sober, or working the steps to get the power to stay sober, or working the steps to get the power to want to make these amends. Who wants to go and, you know, I mean, I was never going to get the power. I'm powerless. If the very first thing I say when I walk in the door is I'm powerless, I don't then go and assume some kind of power and power my way through the rest of this stuff. I have to get to the power, to the thing which will transform me. And for me, that also meant a surrender beyond anything I had ever surrendered before, because I was willing to go to God, but I had some things that I wanted. I wanted to be really skinny, and I wanted to have a lot of disposable income, and I wanted to have a lot of power, because that makes me feel good, and all this other stuff. And it was not until some deep emotional bottoms, and I hear people in the rooms talk about, I hit a sober bottom, or I had a nervous breakdown, or I had a nervous breakthrough, whatever it is. And that made me willing. And it made me willing to be able to go to my higher power and say, you know what? I don't care what you do with me. I really don't care what you do with me. Just please do something. I had to go without a wish list. It did not work for me to go to God with a wish list. You know, make my relationship happy, make me skinny, make blah, blah, blah. That did not work. And what do I know anyway about what I need? That's why step 7 says, take all of me, good and bad. Even my good impulses, I can screw up or screw somebody over. I mean, I'll be the most helpful person in the world to you up until the moment that I realize that I'm really just dominating and controlling you. But I actually had great intentions when it started out. I don't know what to do with myself. I have to have a God of my understanding, the thing that makes me go, the divine spark, the electricity that runs me through the day cannot be me, because I will always default to self-seeking motives. I will always default to selfish and inconsiderate habits, because I have distorted thinking about myself, and I think that it's a good strategy to go through the day trying to get my way, or with the thought that, what's going to happen to me? And that's no way to live. Interestingly enough, last week when I was jawing on about hating the police, within 2 days of doing that, I was swimming. And I swim at the rec center. I've been doing it for many years. And I know the schedule. And I absolutely know that for the first 3 months of every year, the Virginia Beach Police Department swims from 8 a.m. to 12 noon every single Wednesday. I do not darken the doorstep. I never go near the place. But 2 days after I sat in here and mouthed off about it, something happened to my brain, and I forgot. And I showed up at the rec center on Wednesday morning. And I have my bathing suit on, I'm wet, I walk in the door, and when I swim, I'm going to be in the water for like 2 hours. So I walk in the door, though, and there's like 100 cops in there, in their bathing suits. And the equipment is everywhere, Virginia Beach Police Department, all this stuff. It's like exploding in my brain. because my head, when I'm unfit spiritually, it's like Grand Central Station, and I'm trying to take every train at the same time. You know, it's just like, and so I'm thinking, I hate the cops, and how could they, you know, and how could I have forgotten, and blah, 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 blah. And while I'm working this all out, and I'm thinking, I can't come back later, I don't have time, all this kind of stuff, one of those cops got out of the water and came up to me and said, you know, it just doesn't seem fair that you have to swim in this dinky little lane here while we're here. Why don't we all scoot over so you can have the nice lane? And I just thought, oh, God, you're taking this away from me? I love hating the cops. But I got in the water, and I had a great swim. And it's the lane right next to the windows, and it's where I love to swim because the sun comes in, and I'm swimming through the sunbeams, and it's just like dancing with God. And the cops had delivered it to me. And that's how this works. I work the steps, and I don't change myself. I can't. I would have if I could have. My life sucked. It was a full-on suck-a-doodle-doo every day. If I could have fixed it, I would have. What I can do is do this work and put myself in a position. You know, there's that position. If you don't want to get screwed, don't assume the position. Well, if you want to get spiritually transformed, put yourself in this position. And that's what I did. I told the truth to you all about hating the cops. I didn't feel great about it. I heard myself saying it. I woke up the next morning. I took it into prayer and meditation. I said, God, I'm willing for you to change me. I'm not excited about it, but I am willing to be different. And what happens? 100 half-naked cops. And how can you hate people that are in bathing suits? Most people don't look that great anyway. I mean, they were vulnerable and chubby, and I mean, I just couldn't work up my hate. I'm off track, so let's just move on.
We're going to page 83. Yes, there's a long period of reconstruction ahead. We must take the lead. A remorseful mumbling that we're sorry won't fill the bill at all. We ought to sit down with the family and frankly analyze the past as we now see it, being very careful not to criticize them. Their defects may be glaring, but the chances are that our own actions are partly responsible. So we clean house with the family, asking each morning in meditation that our Creator show us the way of patience, tolerance, kindness, and love. The spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. Unless one's family expresses a desire to live upon spiritual principles, we think we ought not to urge them. We should not talk incessantly to them about spiritual matters. They will change in time. Our behavior will convince them more than our words. We must remember that 10 or 20 years of drunkenness would make a skeptic out of anyone.
Laura. So I have this part sectioned off as family amends, and I had lots of those to do, and it seems like every time I go back home to visit, I have more to make. Having to sit down with the family and frankly analyze the past as we now see it and being careful not to criticize them, that is really hard to do with my family. And I've gone through a lot of growth spurts with my family, and then I feel like sometimes I have little emotional relapses, and then I get better, and then we're all kind of adjusting to my sobriety. I have a brother that ended up getting sober after I did, and I have a father that drinks a lot and is probably one of us. I told him he was one of us, but apparently we're not supposed to do that. I have a mom that joined Al-Anon for a while and went through the 12 steps of that group to try to learn how to deal with me. And I have two other brothers that are proud atheists. So there's a lot of stuff going on there. And there's been periods where I hated my father in sobriety because he was drinking. I hated him for being an alcoholic. I forgot that he's powerless over alcohol just like I am. So I punished him for that for a few years when I first got sober. Didn't really want to have a relationship with him. My mom and I, we are so close, but sometimes too close. And we fight, and then we make up, and it's great. And then we fight some more, and I hang up on her, and then I call her back, and I cry. And it's just like, it's been like that a lot. But over the years, the more I started applying the steps into my life, I started learning how to not be so reactive to her. And she's growing too. She's gotten so much better just by knowing what the 12 steps and the principles are in the Al-Anon program. Our relationship improved almost 100% just from that alone, from her staying on her side and then me trying to stay on my side. But every once in a while, we have our little things. And about a year ago, I went home for Christmas. Now, this happened 2 years ago, and my father, you know, I've learned to accept his drinking. I don't try to change him anymore or preach to him like I used to, you know, recruit him into Alcoholics Anonymous. It's just not going to happen. But I knew that there was some growth going with my relationship with him because he's been watching me all these years. He's watched me grow up in Alcoholics Anonymous and, you know, go from that girl that was a convicted felon, you know, to graduate college and get her first real job and, you know, stay at the same company for almost 10 years. And he's seen me go through all kinds of stuff. And he trusts me now. He believes me. And so he told me he had a falling out with my eldest brother, and he told me that he was going to name me the executor of his will. And I just lost it. And I'm just like, me? Like, why me? You know? And he just basically told me that I've proved myself to him that I'm responsible now. And so this is a case of where my actions, you know, speak a lot louder than any words I could ever say to him, you know, about how, you know, this is the man that wanted to leave me on the streets when I was 17 years old. And now he trusts me to be the executor of his will when he passes. Sometimes when I go home and the family is fighting and I like to insert myself and be my little counselor, put my little counselor hat on and try to help my family, and sometimes it blows up and I have to make more amends because I lose my patience with my family. They know how to push my buttons more than anybody else on this planet. And I said last year at Christmas, they were fighting, my parents, and I got so fed up with it. I said, I told them I hated them. I said, I hate you and I hate our family. And I ran away. I walked out and I left, and I was just like, oh my God, now I have to go back and make that amends to them. Again, like, I'm still acting like a little 17-year-old when I go back home with my family. And I've been sober. I'm about to have 8 years of sobriety. But it was cool because this time when I came back and they were already, I guess they had already calmed down and they were just waiting for me. And I came back in and we sat down and we just had an honest conversation about what's going on with us as a family and, you know, what can we do to make this right. And the three of us fixed it. And I, you know, I made amends for what I said and told them, you know, I didn't really mean that, but it's just frustrating, you know, dealing with our family, and I want us to be better. And so, you know, that's not stuff I knew how to do before coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, talking about tolerance and kindliness and love and not criticizing other people, that's a big challenge to do, because I like to say the reason why I am the way I am is because the way you are the way you are, and I react to you, but it's just not the truth. The spiritual life is not a theory, we have to live it. Again, that's just, it doesn't matter how I can tell you, you know, I can quote anything in this book and I can do all the amends, you know, I can do nightly amends and pray every single day, but if I'm not applying it, putting it into practical application in all areas of my life, then it kind of defeats the purpose and I stop growing. You know, with my family, talking about we should not talk incessantly to them about spiritual matters, I also did that very, very wrong. When I first got into AA and it was working for me, I was very excited. And I was a walking advertisement for Alcoholics Anonymous, trying to get everybody sober. And that's not very attractive to other people. With my father, too, my father and the two atheists in my family, trying to talk to them about God and convince them that their ideas are wrong. And those conversations do not go well. I got on this little kick a year ago where I wanted to start, you know, trying churches and studying the Bible because I had never done that before. I condemned it. You know, I was one of those people that was contempt prior to investigation. So I'm on this kick and I'm reading the Bible and I want to know what the meaning of Christmas is. And I go home and I buy my mom like these religious books for Christmas. And she's just like, what are you doing? And just like, that's what this is talking about. You know, it's okay if I want to do this stuff for myself, if I want to explore spirituality and, you know, religion or whatever I want to do. But I can't push that on my family or, you know, my loved ones. I cannot do that. And it keeps talking about my behavior is going to convince them more than anything I could ever say. And yeah, that's all I have. Thanks.
My first AA sponsor was a nun down at Star of the Sea Catholic Church in Virginia Beach. And she had me, the very first amends that I made were to my family. And she had me go to them and sit down with each person. And I mean, I don't know if I knew what I was doing at the time, but I was sincere and I did mean it. Today, though, the most kindly and tolerant and loving thing that I can do with my family, who are all active in one or another parts of this disease, is I do not arrogantly assume that I know what they should be doing with their lives. I can look at something and automatically judge it, but what do I really know? I have this little old lady neighbor who is home all the time, and she's always looking out the window. And she likes to report in what's going on. And she called me one day, and she told me about this guy, Joe. And she said, well, you know, he's cheating on his girlfriend because there are two young girls. One has blonde hair and one has brown hair, and they're in and out of there at all hours of the night. And she had seen what she had seen, and she had put the facts together the way that it probably made sense. But here's the thing. I know Joe, and I happen to know that Joe has two daughters who live with him and that they go to different schools, and they have different schedules, and that's who's going in and out of the house. So that story is an illustration for me that I cannot rely on what I think I see. Because I'm always seeing it through a filter of self. I'm always seeing it with my fears and my insecurities or any unresolved conflict that I may have in my past. I'm going to bring that garbage up, and I'm going to pollute the present thing. And I'm probably not going to be able to see it very clearly at all. And so the best way for me to operate with my family is I am pleasant, I am kind, I am sports, weather, and news, unless somebody asks me to have a deeper conversation, which is rare. And when I am directly asked to help out, my oldest brother has multiple sclerosis, and I help him. But nobody else in the family knows that. I don't want anybody else knowing it. It's, you know, it's the right thing for me to do. He lives around the corner from me. I can't screw it up that it's God's will for me because he's right there. I could stand on my front porch and scream his name. He'd hear me. So it's clear to me that that is part of God's will for me. It is not clear to me that my other brother needs to quit smoking dope, or that my other sister who fell down a flight of stairs drunk and now she's in a wheelchair paralyzed from the waist down, that she really could use some 12-step literature. That isn't for me. This is a program of attraction, not promotion. I doubt that any of them are watching me closely enough or, you know, having any comprehension of what it is that I do, that they are going to say, oh, Amy, you know, Saint Amy. I mean, I'd like it to happen, but it's not going to happen. You know, please help us. It hasn't happened yet. It's not going to happen. And actually reading this, what a gift. God is so good, because yesterday was my birthday and my mom didn't call me. And I've been really whiny and emotional about it for about 24 hours, about up until the time that I sat down here and I read this about how he is yet a long way from making good to the wife or parents whom for years he has so shockingly treated. I have been a full-on devil to my mother. I mean, if she forgets my birthday, what, you know, she's got more important stuff to do. She plays cards on Sundays, whatever. And that is a way that I can be kind and loving, because there would have been a time when I would have called her up and gotten her on the phone and said, you better be dead. You didn't call me for my birthday. You better be dead. But then, of course, my crazy head would be going, oh, my gosh, what if she is dead? What am I going to do? I mean, it just never works out, you know? I don't even want to know what I think. You don't want to know what I think. I don't even want to know what I think. The way for me to move forward in this program of recovery is to continuously take myself back to the God of my understanding. Keep presenting myself, keep turning it over. Keep remembering that everything I do is based on that relationship that was described to me in step three. He will be the director, I will be the actor. And I love that because I love movies. And directors, they have all the power. It's not the actor. I am just the person who shows up. And there's a script. I'm told what to say. I'm told what to wear. I'm told the look I'm supposed to have on my face while I'm saying it. That is very clear to me. That's how I am to be operating. And so with my family, the way of kindliness, tolerance, and love is to leave them to God. They all have a higher power. I am not it. That's all.
Thank you. We only have a couple more minutes. We'll read one more paragraph and just share for a couple minutes, and we'll close it up. On page 83, there may be some wrongs we can never fully right. We don't worry about them if we can honestly say to ourselves that we would right them if we could. Some people cannot be seen. We send them an honest letter. And there may be a valid reason for postponement in some cases. But we don't delay if it can be avoided. We should be sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble without being servile or scraping. As God's people, we stand on our feet. We don't crawl before anyone.
I have two examples of this one. The first part, when it talks about there's some wrongs we can never fully right, and there are some people that cannot be seen. I had an amends that needed to be made after an ex-boyfriend of mine took his own life. And I had a lot of unfinished business there, and obviously he was gone. I couldn't do a direct amends with him. So this is something that, you know, it's taken me some time to get to a place where first I needed to have a conversation with God about, you know, reviewing my part in that entire situation and the relationship as a whole, and doing amends. It's wonderful if you can make an amends and make something right for another person, but the biggest spiritual benefit for me has been no longer being a prisoner to myself and the guilt and the shame that I feel because of the things that I've done. And so with this particular amends that couldn't be made in person, I had to, you know, I've written letters to him on Facebook. I've had conversations with him, you know, I just talked to him. And I've cried, and I've asked for forgiveness, and, you know, I just talk. And that's kind of how, you know, I've moved through that amends with that particular individual. And the second part, I guess, you know, I don't know if this is a wrong I can't fully write, but I had a brother that got very upset with me and cut me out of his life and refused to speak to me. And when I tried to reach out to him a couple times over the years to make an amends to him, and he said, the best thing you can do is just leave me alone. And so over the years, that would weigh really heavily on me. And, you know, some people might say, well, then respect his wishes and leave him alone. And I did do that. But sometimes I feel like, I don't know, God just moves me. And this was another example where I gave it some time, a couple years, I didn't talk to him. And then I decided one year to send him a Christmas card. And I had never done that before. And when he responded and he contacted me on an email, and he let me have it. He told me about myself and, you know, was pretty unforgiving. But at the end of it, he said, but if this is a sincere attempt to try to make things right, then I'm open to hearing what you have to say. And I was like, whoop, there's my end. And And so I had to be, I didn't even have any time to think about what I was going to say. I was so excited that he was opening the door a crack. And this is, you know, that the situation with him is he has a part, and he definitely did not do things as well as he could have, but I had a part, and that's all he wanted me to acknowledge was my part and not blame him for what happened, and that's what I had done in the past. And so it's specific. It says, you know, tactful, considerate, humble, but also not to be servile or scraping, that I didn't have to be his doormat. And, you know, and sometimes he can be like that and, you know, taking, you know, some pretty brutal attacks of the truth about my character. And, you know, everything he said about me was true. And so I just acknowledged what he said, and I told him that I can see now how I played a part in that situation, and I should have never, you know, I told him what I should have done instead. And I told him that I loved him, and that, you know, if you don't want me in your life anymore, then I understand that and I accept that, but I would love, if there's a way to make this right, to do that. And he said, well, this is the beginning. And I was like, wow. And it only took 6 years for that to happen. So, yeah, those are my examples of that.
I have had people that have died before I got around to making amends to them. I've also had people that I couldn't find. They had moved, and there was just nothing I could do. But so much of this work takes place in the first 8 steps before I even get to this, that change has occurred inside of me. I am no longer living the way I was living when I was doing these things. And in the cases where I can't go to someone because they died or I can't find them, what it seems like has come up for me is that some kind of indirect thing will happen. Like other people will want to talk about, oh, remember the time that blah, 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 and you blah, 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 blah. And there's a great definition of the word surrender, and it means it is without defense, no longer defending. And that really resonates with me because I am a person who can really tell you a glamorous story about myself. And I can rationalize every horrible thing I've ever done. I can totally take apart everything everybody else done, and I'll come up looking like a rose at the end of it. And so for me, surrender in this process, a lot in these cases, has been that I don't try to deposit my story anywhere. I keep my mouth shut. If I can't think of anything else at all, I'd say to myself, you know, God bless them and change me. But I don't take the opportunity to do any kind of spin control or impression management. It's not my job. What other people think of me or whatever the story is that's out there, those are consequences. And I have done a lot of really crappy stuff. And so I don't take the opportunity to tell my story or tell my side of things. What I say a lot of the time is, I can see how they would feel that way. And I really can. And I know that what's really going on is not what's going on between me and the person who's talking, or me and the person who's already dead, or me and the person that I can't find. What's really going on is between me and God. And God is giving me another chance. I'm always being called to deeper and deeper surrender. Let go of the story. Keep looking at the causes and conditions. Keep taking a look at how I'm living out of self. That's how I live this way of life. That's what amends bring me to. Thanks.
I'd like to thank the panel, Laura and Amy. We're going to pass the 7th tradition basket. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the 7th tradition is essential at every level of AA service. Both the privilege and responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, local services, district area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. The amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world. And I have one announcement. Our next Supper and a Speaker is about a month away. It's going to be on Monday, March the 7th. We have a 6 o'clock potluck supper. Bring a dish if you wish to eat. And we have a 7 o'clock speaker, and it's going to be Mark G. from Richmond. And we have blue flyers over on the table. Are there any other AA announcements? Okay. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Would all home group members raise their hands? All right, the important question of the night. I see some new faces tonight. Are there anyone here in their first 30 days of sobriety? We'd like to get to know you by your first name, if you would like to share that. Anybody here in their first 30 days?
Hey, Brian, welcome.
All right. We do have literature on the table. If you can fold it, it's free. There are books for sale over there. And just see one of us or myself, one of the home group members or myself, if you want to purchase a book. Sponsorship is AA. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. Anyone willing to be a sponsor, please raise your hand. Also, if you have any questions and you're shy, you want to come up and talk to me after the meeting, I'll be glad to answer any questions about sponsorship. Okay. Smokers, please use the butt cam provided and stay away from the front door because there are other people using the church. And we do record our meetings, and you can find them on our website and re-listen to them on simpleactions.net. And we're going to thank the panel one more time for sharing. We clean up and close up the meeting. We are everyone's invited and encouraged to continue the conversation at the meeting after the meeting at Plaza del Sol on 22nd and Colonial. If you hit the railroad track, you've gone too far. Is there someone that'll read the last two paragraphs? Oh, there it is, David.
Hi, Brandon. I'm an alcoholic named David. Hey, David. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
All right. Thanks, everybody. We close with the Lord's Prayer.
It's in our nature.
He might be.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not to temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory.